Investors Chronicle.
On the show this week, we've got Alex Newman, Julian Hoffman and Mark Robinson back to talk through the IC's special FTSE 350 review, as well as some chat about the implications of Elon Musk's latest big purchase. All that and more to come. Welcome back to the Companies and Markets Show. It is Thursday, the 28th of April, as we record. Joined in the studio by Mark Robinson. Hello, Mark.
Hiya, John.
Haven't spoken since Easter. Did you have a good one?
Yes, it was fine, actually. Didn't do a great deal. Got down, what did I get down? I got down to Wembley one day. Was that over Easter? Yes, I think it was.
Lovely stuff.
Chelsea and Crystal Palace.
Oh yeah, Chelsea win. Are you a Chelsea fan?
No, Hull City, strangely enough. But I just went with friends of mine who happens to be Palace supporters, and it was grand.
Oh, not for them, presumably.
Oh, it was just a great day out.
Given the result. also, Alex Newman. Hi, Alex.
Hi, John. How you doing?
Good, thank you. Also, same question. Also, a good time.
I think I had sinusitis. I can't remember. It was a bit of a blur of, yeah. So yeah, I watched the Chelsea Palace game though.
Right. Yeah.
That was about the highlight.
And then Julian Hoffman as well. Julian, did you watch the Chelsea Palace game?
No. I redid my patio.
Nice.
Excitingly, and not for any dubious reasons. It just needed redoing.
Right, before we get into our discussion, let's have a quick news roundup from the week that's been. Biggest news this week, probably the Twitter board agreeing to the sale of the company to Elon Musk for around $44 billion or $54 a share. In a statement, Musk said, "Free speech is the bedrock of a functioning democracy and Twitter is the digital town square where matters vital to the future of humanity are debated. I also want to make Twitter better than ever by enhancing the product with new features, making the algorithms open source to increase trust, defeating the spam bots, and authenticating all humans." We're going to have a quick chat about this in a moment or two, but I'll just finish the little news roundup. Elsewhere, minor Anglo-American shares were down 7% on Monday, partly due to a recommendation by the Environmental Assessment Service of Chile to block the expansion of a copper mine. Anglo said 120% of the emissions linked to it would be mitigated, and a full decision is expected within the next week. Soft drinks company Nichols said chair John Nichols intends to retire after spending more than 50 years in the business. John is the grandson of John Noel Nichols, who invented the company's best-known product, Vimto, in 1908. Bit of trivia for you there. Indonesia, the world's biggest producer and exporter of palm oil, has announced an export ban on oil from Thursday. Details of this policy are a little hazy at the moment, but it could have potentially serious consequences for several London-listed palm oil producers such as MP Evans and Anglo Eastern Plantations. Chris Akers has the full write-up on the IC website. Quick look at the markets. FTSE 100 dipped sharply open on Monday before recovering to around the 7,500 mark at time of recording. S&P 500 has lost nearly 7% since last Thursday. Dow and Nasdaq reflecting similar losses over there in the US. Right.
I might just say that story about Nichols was topical insofar as I think we've either come to the end or coming to the end of Ramadan. And Vimto is a drink which is closely associated, not necessarily with the Prophet Muhammad, but when they move into Eid and break the fast, as it were, I believe. Can you confirm that, Alex?
I know sales were very popular in the Gulf States and the Middle East. Having written up their results once about 5 years ago, that is the nugget I'm going to offer you. But
yes, I'm not quite sure about that. You might have to check that one, John. But
I think it's Saudi Arabia, isn't it? Is their biggest export market?
Yeah,
I remember sort of doing again, like Alex, having done Nichols results probably 12 years ago.
It could have been worse. They could have gone with their AG Bar and Iron Brew.
So is that, it's very popular to break the fast with a bottle of Vimto. Is that what you're...
I think that was the case, yeah. And dates. Mm. But I'm not sure that they were drinking...
It's, it gets you kind of awake again, doesn't it? I think that's the, because it's basically full of sugar. So that sort of keeps you you're spiritual for the rest of Ramadan, I think.
I'm not sure that it was used during the original Hajj, but anyway.
But in the 20th century.
I'm going to be shadow banned now.
Well, a great segue into our first topic, because I do want to circle briefly back to the Musk takeover. Unfortunately, our tech writer Arthur Sants couldn't join us today. So, Julian, given you're the only one out of these three with a Twitter account, I'm going to have to ask you if you're looking forward to all the extra liberation that Musk is about to provide.
I mainly use my Twitter account to troll Olaf Scholz. But yeah, you know, it's an interesting set of developments. I mean, look, it kind of keeps swinging from one way to the other. So it now looks like he's broken some sort of covenant on his agreement, and he's at risk perhaps of not being able to raise the money to buy Twitter. But I mean, the story just, in the sort of typical Elon Musk way, just seems to swing from one extreme to the next. So it could be that the next move is that he's actually sealed it without any issues. And he's also managed to annoy the European Union immediately by sort of saying that there, you know, it should be a fully free speech platform. And then the European Commission has to point out that actually there are certain rules that platforms have to adhere to in order to, you know, stop things like hate speech and things like that. So we don't exactly, we're not exactly sure whether this will eventually go through, but... there is that saying, isn't there? You should never underestimate someone who overestimates themselves. So you kind of like he might be wrong sometimes, but occasionally he might be very right about it. And this could be the case with Twitter as well. But with Elon Musk, you just never know. I think that's the honest answer.
Well, what struck me about the whole deal as well, and it links into news earlier in the week about the Disney Corp, is it within the fiduciary obligations of a director to buy up another public company simply on the basis that it isn't adhering to free speech principles? Where's the benefit there to shareholders in Tesla as well, given that you know Twitter is consistently underperformed financially?
But I mean, he's doing it as an individual, isn't he, rather than part of the Tesla story. Though I mean the implication, I think Arthur's piece is quite interesting this week, that for Twitter shareholders, it's kind of a sewn up, you know, there's kind of not much more to say, is there? The deal's either going to go ahead or it's not, and then the share price will fall back down to whatever it was before. But because he's having to commit so much of his Tesla holdings to finance the deal,
yeah,
there is that you know, tie in, though. As you say, it's sort of weirdly tied up, as everything is with the personality / responsibilities of Elon Musk. But I mean
presumably as well, it's going to take up a lot of his energies.
That's a bigger point, isn't it? I mean, like, he's a proven wealth creator, and you know, I mean, he's a bit of a sort of a poly-business genius, having done PayPal, SpaceX, Tesla. But this seems more like a vanity project than the other ventures in that he's committed to. But I mean, you know, for Tesla shareholders worrying about the stock dropping or being, you know, affected by this, it's also worth bearing in mind that, you know, they trade on 16 times price to sales, which is five times as expensive as the automotive industry.
Yeah.
So it's not like this isn't a, you know, insanely frothy company to begin with. It's just a kind of crazy story, isn't it? But the read across for markets is fairly minimal, really, in a way.
Well, it's almost like that. It is the time that you do vanity projects, isn't it? When your core holdings are so valued at such high levels, you can just pick everything up at fractions of what they should be in the dollar, isn't it? I mean, there is a kind of business logic to it. I mean, the other interesting thing was, wasn't it Jeff Bezos who was stirring it up by saying that the Twitter deal might take Musk's you know, eye off the core of his business or something. There was a bit of mutual billionaire trolling.
Well, the implication being that Tesla having targeted China as such a big market now may have a sort of awkward leverage held over them by the People's Republic, given that, you know, freedom of speech and the public square that Twitter represents is perhaps antithetical to some of the, you know, the way China seeks to be portrayed. I mean, it's a speculative one.
And from a practical perspective as well, I guess the further you move up the food chain, the further you move away from the actual mechanics of running a company on a day-to-day basis. But, you know, it's just that he's, like other people like Rupert Murdoch, he's synonymous with his organization.
I'll just leave you with a final thought from B.A. Friedman on Twitter. He wrote that, "I don't know who needs to hear this, but you're putting more thought into the implications of Elon Musk buying Twitter than Elon Musk did." I tend to agree with that one. Right, let's move on, because this week we've got a FTSE 350 special in our magazine this week. An extra, 40 pages of content on the top 350 companies in the UK, and we're going to hear about them, a few of them now, if that's all right, guys. Alex, could you just maybe just give an overview of the feature? Like, what have we done here? Have we ranked our companies?
Yeah, I know. I should hand all credit to Dan Jones, the deputy editor, for sort of heroically piecing all of this together. Having done it in the past a few times, it's a pretty tough undertaking, and we haven't run a FTSE 350 review since 2020, when we actually ran two, both before and just after the market crash. But I mean, the general idea behind it is to provide a guide to the largest and most closely followed shares in the UK market. So that's both the FTSE 100 and the next 250 companies which follow, so the FTSE 350 in total. And we break down each sector, subsector, and look at the prospects for the companies and the themes which are likely to affect the companies within those subsectors in similar ways over the coming year. Give our sort of favourites and outsiders takes on where they're heading, and to provide some sort of data backdrop to how the market has done over the last year and what analysts are forecasting for the coming one.
Mm. Yeah, credit to Dan. It's a massive undertaking. We've had these articles sort of dripping in for the last month or two, it seems. But you've all written pieces covering various sectors. Be good to hear about a few of them. Mark, what have you written about? What comments have you made?
Firstly, to add to what Alex just said then as well, we try and make these pieces as forward-looking as possible rather than looking over our shoulders, but that's true of everything that we do. What struck me about the sectors that I was looking at this time around is that it was the level of government intervention in each one of these sectors. And I guess it might be slightly naive on my part, that this is probably an everyday occurrence, but I was looking at defence utilities, tobacco, automobile parts, and then healthcare equipment as well. And also chemicals. And all of these sectors to varying degrees have been affected profoundly by government legislation and regulatory change over the last year or so. And to give you an example, you know, tobacco company, we should actually be updating these things as we go along. But I missed this point the other day, is that there was an announcement that tobacco companies could be slapped on the additional annual levy of up to $700 million under government proposals, which have been put forward by Javed Khan, who is the government's anti-smoking czar.
I didn't know we had one of them.
There's a czar for everything and everything in its place. So he's looking at whether to advise ministers to increase the minimum age for smoking up to 21 or 25, or take New Zealand's approach that outlaws smoking for anyone born after 2008. And there's also talk that e-cigarettes might end up on NHS prescriptions. So, I mean, all of this is absolutely fine. And it's difficult arguing against it from a healthcare perspective. But it just seems odd to me, you know, why not a total ban? Because it just seems to be a drip, drip, drip on that sector. And so we've got a position at the moment for investors. But plenty of our readers or our listeners will be shareholders in BATS and Imperial, largely down to the yield on offer at the moment. BATS is probably the more viable option of the two, because Imperial leverage to the hilt, but they're highly cash generative businesses, and they're trying to restyle themselves with a new range of products that they've got might actually have some health benefits in terms of like opportunity costs. It stops you smoking, you know, conventional tobacco products, and presumably moving on to heroin at some point after that. They're all sort of focusing on the new category products, I think is one of the generic terms for it as well. But interestingly, with Imperial too, they're also prioritizing, they've got a sort of a Stalin-esque 5-year plan where they're looking at targeting a specific end markets, the traditional ones actually, whereas you know, we're looking at the US, UK, Australia, and so on. Whereas BATS are not only growing their alternative products, but of course they've been targeting emerging and frontier market economies, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Vietnam, which are the only places at the moment where you're getting some growth in the number of people taking up smoking. Because in Western markets, especially amongst the young, that's fallen off a cliff. And that's obviously one of the structural issues facing the tobacco companies. It just seems to me that it's odd that they've been, I find it slightly unfair that they've given this pariah status, because it's a legal product, and it's undoubtedly true that it's had incredibly detrimental health effects down through the decades. But it's also within the law, and it also provides a huge chunk of tax revenue every year. But it's probably just my reactionary stance, really, to government intervention. But you've also got a point at the moment where today, I think Rishi Sunak was talking about levying another tax charge on the oil companies for excess profits. So I don't know what an excess profit is. You know, if you're a shareholder in Shell or BP, are you going to look at this with some trepidation? I mean, what is this excess product, a profit? I don't know. It's sort of a mercantilist approach we seem to be taking at the moment, which is anathema for anyone trading in public markets, or at least that's my view on it.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, a lot of the market swing in the last year with the Hill Review, et cetera, seems to be we have to bend over backwards to reward, you know, entrepreneurs and do whatever they say, almost take a sort of light touch regulatory approach, because these are the wealth creators. But, and there's lots we can say and debate about the merits of doing that. But it's interesting, the really stodgy, mature industries that the FTSE 100 is packed with, has these, they're kind of like sitting targets at the same time, aren't they? I mean, what are the tobacco companies going to do if they lop another tax on them? What are the house builders going to do if the levy gets bumped up? Ditto. I mean, Shell and BP, they're slightly different beasts, because they're so wildly profitable globally. There's not really a unified global windfall tax move there. It's very sort of like piecemeal.
And I think the Chancellor as well, to be fair to him, he was going to link that tax on supplementary tax on profits to their investment activities. I didn't see any other details whether that relates to non-fossil fuel investments. I'm not quite sure about. And it seems to me anyway that the oil majors are actually making fairly substantial commitments on this part. I mean, we're in a position at the moment where there's an energy crisis, and partly that's down to the fact that investment fell off a cliff from 2015, and then after the after COVID-19 as well. So it's very difficult to just suddenly come up with replacement barrels overnight. You can't do it. And what we're seeing at the present time, or at least partially, is down to the lack of sort of investment in the intervening period. What do you think, Julian?
Oh, right. Yes, sorry. I think you've been reading Ayn Rand again, Robbo, isn't it? When Atlas Shrugged. No, it's an interesting point, and it is a phenomenon that's sort of spilling over into these mature industries as well. You notice a lot in the pharma sector, for example, which I seem to be covering at the moment a lot, that reference pricing is also getting tighter. So that's another way of taxing companies at source, which is really what windfall taxes are, isn't it? They're not based on performance. They're just based on the essential existence of an industry and the profits it makes, isn't it? And you kind of wonder whether intellectually that is a sign that the idea of free and unfettered markets is pretty much in retreat. I mean, it seems to be a global phenomenon that we're going back to a more corporatist economic system, isn't it? And that might be reflecting the insecurity we feel around supply chains and all these kind of interlinked kind of problems. And the obvious answer is that the governments are taxing in order to, in a sense, to repatriate that capital back to the homeland and build up resilience in their supply and capacity. Maybe that could be a broader economic point. We'd have to ask Rutland's most famous Marxist economist, Chris Dillay, whether he agrees with that. But so we could get Chris on next time. He's before he retires. That would be quite good.
Yeah, we definitely should. Definitely should. Julian, just back to the FTSE 350. What have you looked at for the IC?
Yeah, so I looked at I covered banks, insurers, and pharmaceutical companies. I think that was the three the main ones. And you can sort of sum it up in relatively simple terms. Like, the banks are going to benefit from higher rates this year. That's essentially a government driven profit drive, more or less. The insurer seems to be benefiting as well from everyone paying higher premiums. Inflation's feeding through that into that industry, and that tends to benefit the payouts that investors are getting. So a lot of people are eyeing up the yields that insurers are generating as a form of inflation-proof income in a sort of funny sort of way. But even with the insurers, if you take that, some of them are returning up to 19% of their yielding like 19% once you include all the special dividends and the buybacks and things like that. So that's an incredibly enticing proposition for a lot of shareholders who are struggling, to try and generate an income out of their capital that keeps pace with the rate of their cost increases. And the last one I looked at was in detail pharmaceutical companies. And the story there in the FTSE 350 is really about the emerging competition between Glaxo and AstraZeneca. AstraZeneca has a decade-long head start on Glaxo when it comes to improving the quality and value of its product pipelines. And Glaxo recently has been trying to redirect the company towards higher value or generating higher value. And part of that process is going to be splitting up in the end of this quarter the old consumer products business and essentially using the proceeds or the ability to generate using the leverage that they can generate out of that to refit and restock their pharmaceutical product pipeline, which ultimately is far more valuable to the company than selling toothpaste and Lucozade or as was. So that's the three kind of themes in there. The market is looking at trying to find sources of income, and I think that's going to be a dominating trend really for all of those sectors, because they're all essentially cash machines in one way or another for investors if they get their business models right.
Did I read you wrote a little summary of Glaxo's first quarter results? Did I read they've come up with a better name for their new for when they split up, the new GSK?
They're going to call it Helion.
Helion,
which is going to be the consumer products arm, and they're trying to find the great and the good at the moment to staff the board. It's probably something that should have happened years ago. I mean, the merger has held both sides of the company up, as it was the old Glaxo and the old Beecham companies that combined. And so I think you could say that they're on the kind of journey towards revitalizing the share price in both of those entities when Helion eventually lists and Glaxo starts to see some sort of benefit from restocking its pipeline. So I mean, that's quite an interesting corporate restructuring story. So I've gone into that a bit in the FTSE 350 piece. In terms of other pharma companies, there's not that many left. So you've got a couple of generic suppliers, one of which has a markets in North Africa, and the others seem to have either disappeared or been sold off. The sector looks very, very top heavy when it comes to what's actually available to the UK investor.
Hmm. Well, thanks, Julian. And then Alex, I don't know if you want to mention yours as well. You wrote a few house builders that you have again. And
yeah, I think it's my swan song writing about property, hopefully, given that we've Mitchell has just joined the team as our new property writer. Yeah, so I mean, the themes, they're probably familiar to people who've listened to the podcast in the last couple of months, but the house builders completely beaten up, but I think there's probably value there, and the updates from a few of those this week implied that, you know, interest rates going to 0.75% is not terminal for their businesses, even if more people are now predicting that house price bubble is likely to peak this year. I mean, it has to at some point. And then the sort of hodgepodge that is the REIT sector, where you have so many different subsectors to that. It's kind of difficult to surmise it all in one theme, other than, you know, the effects of inflation and interest rates. But I suppose the top line for the REITs is where is demand the strongest among tenants. The office sector looks quite shaky, I think. Even though there are pockets which are reportedly coming back quite strongly, the self-storage game has run up incredibly in the last few years, and those companies looking quite highly valued, but demand is still very strong there. Ditto the logistics and warehouse businesses, Mitchell in his inaugural piece is week is did a really good write up about asking whether there's a bubble in sheds, which is sort of weird concept, isn't it? But that's a good sort of a segue to something that investors in that space should be looking at over the coming months.
Is that utility sheds, isn't it, for sort of industrial estates, not garden sheds?
That's right. It's not. The other thing you didn't mention that you did on your Easter break, Julian, you put up a shed as well. I think you undersold yourself. You laid a patio.
No, I took down a shed.
You took down a shed. Storm. Sorry.
Okay. I took down my storm damaged shed. But yeah. uh,
Which is another reason why you shouldn't invest in sheds that size.
Lovely stuff. Well, thanks, guys. Yeah, well worth a read, FTSE 350 supplement. As I said, there breaks down the FTSE 350 into various sectors. I think 37, maybe more than that. I think I counted 37. And yeah, our team of writers has given an overview of the sector and a favourite company as well as an outsider. So yeah, well worth looking at. Right, before we head up, any other business, Julian? Something on travel?
Yeah, some interesting stuff out this week on travel companies, or at least companies that are dependent on people traveling. So the first one was WH Smith, which seems to be seeing a recovery in its sales, basically based on the fact that they've got lots of outlets in train stations and airports. So that everybody stuck in the lines at, say, Manchester Airport can buy something to read. And the other one was Go Ahead Group, which is the long and lastly unlamented runner of the South East Rail franchise, I believe, or as was. And Gemma wrote a really interesting piece about how that company is trying to emerge from its long sort of 2-year pandemic-induced slump. But the most interesting thing that came out of that is how much it seems to be sweating its assets. So it's the company's depreciation versus its capital spending is out of sync. So the average age of its fleet of what's left of its buses and trains has gone up sort of 2 years. So that, you know, that there seems to be a, although that's fine in the short term, that there seems you can sort of predict in a couple of years' time that the capital cost of replacing everything is going to be quite high. So I thought that was an interesting point that Gemma picked up there. So even despite the fact that more people are traveling, we're still below pandemic levels. Investors shouldn't look too early for a recovery in that sector, or at least try to time it a little bit better, because they could end up essentially having to finance a complete recapitalization if you get in at the wrong time.
Surely renationalization is the way forward.
Yes, so speaks the libertarian. Yes, I think it might be. Yes, I don't know. It seems to be the only way that you can run massive capital assets effectively, isn't it? Because the state is the only one that has the financial ability to borrow at low rates in order to finance the spending you need to keep it running. So, I mean, this long sort of nightmare of franchises and things like that, it just hasn't really worked. Does it? I mean, you have to be sort of honest about it. They might do better with buses, but even there, they, you know, certain regions are starting to regulate bus services, and you could almost say that yields are going to be squeezed because of that.
Nice one, Julian. Thank you. What are you working on this week? Anything good?
I've got a tip idea to write for Alex. Yep, and I don't know. I don't think I'm doing anything else particularly. I think that'll take up most of my week, I think.
Nice.
And then Mark, it's a bank holiday again on Monday.
It is another bank holiday. We're being spoiled. Mark, you're taking stock back this week?
Yes. Going along the lines of what I was talking about earlier on, the fiduciary responsibilities of directors and how they seem to have been skewed of late. Nice. IMO.
Nice. Ideas Farm, Alec.
Yes, ideas. So I've got to follow the Berkshire Hathaway AGM this weekend as well, because I'm writing the cover feature on that for next week. So yeah, I'll be tuning in to Omaha at some point on Saturday for my sins.
Nice. Working on a weekend. That's that dedication.
Is that going to be quite late at night? It's going to be quite late at night for you, isn't it, Alex?
Yeah, look. I'm you've rumbled me. I'll watch the highlight reel for the next day.
Great stuff. Well, that's all for us this week. Nice to have you all back after a week off. And we'll see you again, listener, same time next week. Thank you very much. The Companies and Market Show was edited and produced by me, John Rogers. And don't forget to head on over to our Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Acast channel, hit subscribe, and we'll turn up straight into your feed each Friday. See you next week.